From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. The new members of the Palestinian parliament will be sworn in on Saturday. The majority of the seats will be held by Hamas, whose charter calls for the destruction of Israel. On today's Fresh Air, we talk about Hamas and the Israeli and American reactions to its political victory with Greg Myrie, Jerusalem correspondent for The New York Times. And rock critic Ken Tucker shares his new addiction, a website which collects video of vintage rock, soul, and funk performances. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. The news. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The new members of the Palestinian parliament will be sworn in on Saturday. The majority of the seats will be held by members of Hamas, the radical Islamist group whose charter calls for the destruction of Israel. The U.S. considers Hamas a terrorist group. Israel and the U.S. are trying to figure out how to deal with Hamas. Meanwhile, Israelis go to the polls March 28th. Prime Minister Ariel Sharon remains in a coma, and it's unclear how much power the new centrist party he recently founded, Kadima, will have without him. My guest Greg Myrie has been covering the Middle East for 6 years. He's a Jerusalem correspondent for the New York Times. I spoke with him this morning. Yesterday, your colleague from the New York Times, Stephen Erlanger, wrote that the U.S. and Israel are said to be talking about ways of destabilizing Hamas with the hopes, ultimately, of ousting Hamas. He wrote, the intention is to starve the new Palestinian Authority of money and international connections to the point where some months from now, the president of the Palestinian Authority would be compelled to call a new election. The hope is that Palestinians will be so unhappy with life under Hamas that they will return to office a reformed and chastened Fatah movement. American officials have denied trying to oust Hamas. They said they would cut off aid, but the goal isn't to oust Hamas. What has reaction been in Israel?
Along the same lines, I mean, Israel is saying there is no such plot, that they don't have that plan, but they are certainly talking about lots of ways to make life difficult for a Hamas government. They're saying very soon, perhaps as soon as Saturday, when the new Palestinian parliament is sworn in, that they will consider it to be a Hamas government, and at that point, a lot of things could take effect, including a cutoff of funds, a further limiting of travel, things like that. So Israel and a lot of other countries as well are still trying to formulate a policy with this Hamas government coming to power, and we still have to wait and see what's going to happen. But Israel again is denying that they have such a plan to force the ouster of the Hamas government, but they're certainly thinking about and talking about a lot of things to make life very tough.
Oh, have you heard any reaction from Hamas?
The Hamas reaction has been that these were democratic elections that the United States and the West has been calling for quite some time, and it should be respected. And they're saying it would be completely unjust and improper to then start trying to undermine or in some way force capitulation of a democratically elected government. They say this is what the West has been asking the Palestinians to do, and they've done it. That decision should be respected.
If the United States and Israel, you know, basically cut off Hamas, Hamas can possibly go to Iran and other Islamic states for support. How close is Hamas to Iran now?
There have certainly been contacts for a long time. I recall even being in Iran in the mid-90s, and they had representatives and an office there and people there. So they've had links to the Iranian leadership for quite some time. That's not new. The depth and strength of that tie has always been open to question. The Hamas leader in exile, Khalid Mishal, has met with the Iranian leadership fairly recently. So there are long-standing existing ties. We'll have to see exactly how strong those ties become, and will the Iranians be willing to put up literally tens of millions of dollars is the kind of money that a Palestinian government would need if it gets cut off from Israel and the United States.
Hamas has said that it can't recognize Israel, but it can accept a truce and live side by side with Israel and refer all of these issues to the coming generations. Does Hamas have conditions before it would be willing to live by such a truce?
Right. The Hamas position, they've said this for some time now, many years in fact, is that if Israel would withdraw to the 1967 borders, Hamas would be willing to accept the creation of a Palestinian state and a long-term truce with Israel. From Israel's side, this is a complete non-starter. I mean, these are the kinds of things that would be negotiated if there were negotiations, how far Israel might pull back in the West Bank. So Israel says, well, these are the kinds of things we have to negotiate. These are not the kind of things we're going to do in advance. Israel also says that if we make concessions, we'd want a peace treaty, a permanent peace treaty that recognizes Israel, that accepts its existence, that accepts its borders, not a sort of long-term truce, as Hamas talks about, that could be broken at another time. Israelis would say this is just a way for Hamas to look a little more moderate, that they're willing to accept some sort of compromise, but they would say it's really trying to push the same Hamas idea of eliminating or destroying Israel, but just doing it in stages, going back to the 67 borders, and then future generations would seek to further reduce or eliminate Israel.
Well, if there isn't a truce between Hamas and Israel, what's the other option? War?
Well, something in between, perhaps, and that's what we really don't know. Now, for the past year, Hamas has abided by, largely, this as they're calling it, taidiyah, calm in Arabic, and the Hamas has not carried out any major attacks in the past year. It's quite possible that this sort of arrangement could carry on, either informally or perhaps in a slightly more formal way. With Hamas people in the leadership, it's hard to imagine that they have anything to gain in the short term by carrying out renewed attacks. So the most likely scenario, at least for the moment, and even the Israeli security officials acknowledge this, that Hamas has basically been abiding by this truce. So we could see this kind of truce, even though Hamas government and an Israeli government are not talking to each other, not having any real relations, there could be a fair amount of quiet. The complicating factor would be some of the other factions, like Islamic Jihad, which has not been party to the truce and which has carried out a half dozen or so suicide bombings in the past year. If they continue to act and carry out attacks, what will Hamas do? Will Hamas try to stop them? Hamas has given no indication, in fact, says they won't. And then how would Israel respond to an attack carried out by another group? Would they target Hamas and the Hamas leadership? So that, I think, is probably the kind of scenario, or the most likely scenario we could be looking at in the coming days and weeks.
There seems to be a little bit of reevaluation of what the Hamas victory means. For example, the Palestinian pollster Khalil Shikaki says that Hamas won only 44% of the popular vote, although it got 56% of the seats. In a lot of districts, Fatah ran several candidates against each other, and they split the Fatah vote, whereas Hamas ran only one candidate in each district. So is there a reevaluation of what the victory actually means?
Well, it's not going to change the result. Hamas has a very clear, solid majority and can govern alone if they wish to do so. But it does show what a disciplined, organized campaign Hamas run and what a rather disorganized campaign Fatah ran in many ways. One constituency in particular, Fatah had its formal candidate and then eight or nine people who were linked to Fatah running, and Hamas had one candidate. Well, the one Hamas candidate ran while all the Fatah-linked people split the vote. And so we have seen this, and if there had been more, if Fatah had just run one candidate in many districts, they would have won a much larger number of seats. It could have been a very close election in that case. That might be an argument for having both Fatah and Hamas in the government together, and Hamas says they would welcome Fatah and other parties in the government, but Fatah says they want to be in the opposition at this stage. So I think the result will be that Hamas will very much dominate the government. They may include a few independents or a few smaller parties, but they are very much going to dominate the government, despite this result, which didn't give them such a large victory just in terms of raw number of votes.
Does it seem like Fatah will willingly give up power to Hamas, or is there any chance that there will be armed fighting between Fatah and Hamas? Right now, Fatah controls the security forces. Hamas has armed militias.
Very interesting question. I would make a distinction there. I think it's very clear Fatah is going to give up power. The Palestinians have gone through a number of these transitions in the past year. I trace it all the way back to Yasser Arafat's death in November of 2004. They had a very smooth transition and an election. They had municipal elections all last year where Fatah mayors were voted out of office and Hamas mayors were voted in. They've had this parliamentary election last month. All of these things have gone quite smoothly without any major unrest or major trouble. And in the Fatah leadership is totally respecting the results of this election and seems ready to step aside. So on that front, I think it's very clear. A Hamas government, Hamas-led government, will come to power here fairly shortly. Now, on the other question about young armed Fatah supporters running around in the streets and Fatah members of the security forces, how will they respond to a Hamas government or to Hamas leading the security forces? That's still a bit of an open question here. It's been 3 weeks since the election now. We haven't had any serious internal trouble, but it's coming to the crunch time in terms of how are the security forces going to be led? Because the security forces are made up largely of Fatah members and supporters with Fatah commanders, and this could change quite dramatically. Hamas may want to bring its own members into the security forces. It certainly wants to lead part of the security forces, at least. Will the Palestinian leader Mahmoud Abbas want to? He has authority over the security forces as well. How are they going to divide up these responsibilities? So all of these weapons, both that are just among gunmen in the streets and among members of the security forces, keeping those under control has not been resolved yet, although I would say we've had 3 weeks since the elections without major trouble. That could be seen as a fairly positive thing.
Has there been a history of armed fighting between Hamas and Fatah?
There has. It has come and gone in some fairly brief periods. Whenever there is an incident and maybe somebody gets shot, the security forces arrest some Hamas people and that causes a shooting, or gunmen from Hamas and Fatah clash. It's tended to be very brief and been the lid has been kept on things. So I wouldn't get overly excited if I saw a single incident or a couple of incidents, and we haven't even really seen that in the past few weeks. But I think there is a long-term question, just how are you going to deal with all these armed groups and how is Hamas going to deal with that? Because the armed men in the streets used to be largely supportive members or are linked to Fatah, and now they're not going to be linked to the government, which will be Hamas. Hamas says they're not going to oppose the Palestinian resistance, but they also are very adamant that they want to exercise greater control and discipline in the Palestinian streets, that there's been a lot of chaos, the security forces have not operated properly. So we will have to see how Hamas wants to deal with these gunmen in the streets, which the Fatah government has basically allowed to roam free.
My guest is Greg Myrie, Jerusalem correspondent for the New York Times. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. If you're just joining us, my guest is Greg Myrie, Jerusalem correspondent for the New York Times. He's speaking to us from Jerusalem. You know, a lot of people say that part of the reason for the Hamas victory was, one, people thought that Fatah just wasn't very competent at running the government, and two, that Hamas had provided a lot of social services for Palestinians. What kind of social services? What had you seen of that part of Hamas?
Well, you see it in a lot of ways. You'll see it in health clinics, which Hamas runs for free, in assistance programs where they provide food, schools that they run as well. It's particularly noticeable in the Gaza Strip, which is Hamas's stronghold, which is a very poor area. Community services they provide that they run out of the mosque in many instances. So Hamas did have this reputation, and they've even strengthened it a little bit in the past year, I'd say, when Hamas mayors or municipal councils have been taken over by Hamas through elections. And in several instances, they've received pretty high marks from the people for just providing basic services, cleaning up the garbage, doing things like this that was not getting done done under Fatah leadership in the local area. So I think this is one area where Hamas is going to concentrate on and feel that they can make a quick, visible, tangible improvement in the lives of Palestinians, just in terms of restoring order on the streets, cleaning up the streets, providing these kinds of services where the Palestinians feel Fatah just didn't deliver. They had a decade or more in power and just were not providing the kinds of services people expected.
The Hamas charter, you know, calls for the destruction of Israel. It describes the struggle against the Jews as a religious obligation for every Muslim. So I know Hamas thinks that Israel has no right to exist and that all Jews need to get out of the land that Hamas considers to be Palestinian land. How anti-Jewish in general is it? Does Hamas stand opposed to Israeli policy or to all Jewish people in general?
Well, they're absolutely and unequivocally opposed to a Jewish state. You will hear various Hamas leaders make various statements about what that might mean. But basically, the one thing they don't compromise on is saying the existence of a Jewish state or a state of Israel in this land, in the Middle East. They will say, for example, that they could tolerate Jewish people living here, but again, in an Islamic state, and that Israel as a state needs to cease to exist, and that they want the people to leave, the Jewish people to leave this area. That's their line. Now, when you question them and ask them, well, that is entirely unrealistic, that's not going to happen. Some people joke about Hamas and their thousand-year plan, that Hamas just feels slowly, they will. This is something they will do over time, and that they're not trying to end the Jewish state tomorrow, but it's something that they will seek in the long term.
On Saturday, the new members of the Palestinian parliament are scheduled to be sworn in. About 10% of the new legislators are actually in Israeli prisons. So what happens to their seats?
Right. Well, they're going to remain empty, that's for sure. Israel is certainly not going to let them out and have their seat. There's 132 seats, and there was 15, Palestinian legislators who were elected but are in jail. I think one actually got released today, a Hamas leader in the West Bank. Brings us to 14, still over 10%. But the more pressing issue, I think, is you have roughly a little more than half of the legislators in the West Bank, a little less than half down in Gaza. They're not going to be able to meet in the same place. Israel has made it very clear they're not going to allow wanted Hamas people to travel back and forth. So the center of gravity of Palestinian politics is going to be very much to Gaza. Yasser Arafat initially moved back and forth, and the Palestinians had a legislature and sort of the president's office in both Gaza City and in Ramallah in the West Bank. Arafat was confined to Ramallah for the last 3 years of his life. And that very much kept all politics sort of in Ramallah, and very little politically happened in the Gaza Strip. Now we're going to see a switch because the Hamas leadership is in Gaza, but they can't leave. The president, Mahmoud Abbas, is in Ramallah. He can travel back and forth, but he's still centered very much in Ramallah. So we're going to see some just awkward situations. In the past couple of years, we've seen the parliament carried out by video conference, where legislators met in Gaza City and in Ramallah at the two parliament buildings and were connected by a video conference. It looks like that's what we're going to see again, but it's going to be a very awkward arrangement, to say the least.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Greg Myrie. He's the Jerusalem correspondent for the New York Times. Israel feels it has no negotiating partner with Hamas because Hamas won't negotiate with Israel and Hamas won't even recognize Israel. So what are some of Israel's options now, since it has no negotiating partner in Hamas?
Right. Israel is saying that three things will have to happen before it will consider having any contacts with Hamas. One, that a Hamas government would have to recognize Israel. Number two, it would have to disavow violence. And number three, it would have to accept the previous agreement signed between Israel and the Palestinian Authority. Now, it doesn't look like Hamas is really going to do any of those things, and I think that's pretty much the expectation of Israel. So I don't see any immediate or short-term solution to that sort of logjam. I can't see there being any real progress. they may find some formula to work out some practical issues. For example, the electricity and the water supply in the West Bank and Gaza are controlled by Israel. It's the Israeli electricity and water system. So they may find that an Israeli government can deal with some non-Hamas officials in the Palestinian Authority to deal with some of these practical issues that need to be dealt with. But in terms of a political dialogue or restarting peace talks, very hard to see how there's going to be any contact there. There is some talk Hamas may try to put in place some technocrats, some people who are not formally part of the organization in some positions, like perhaps a foreign minister, for example, and get around it that way. But Israel is really not buying that. They're saying if it's a Hamas government led by Hamas, we're not going to be dealing with somebody who may not be a formal part of the group at this point. So I don't see any real way forward at this moment in terms of a political dialogue.
Greg Myrie is Jerusalem correspondent for The New York Times. Our conversation was recorded earlier today. He was in a studio in Jerusalem. We'll hear more in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Support for NPR comes from Barnes & Noble, publishers of the Barnes & Noble Classics edition of Emily Bronte's Wuthering Heights, available in stores and online at bn.com. From the Ford Foundation, a resource for innovative people and institutions worldwide, on the web at fordfound.org. And from the Wallace Foundation, supporting ideas, sharing solutions, expanding opportunities, on the web at wallacefoundation.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, rock critic Ken Tucker tells us about a website which collects video of vintage rock, soul, and funk performances. And we continue our conversation with Greg Myrie, Jerusalem correspondent for The New York Times.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with more of our interview with Greg Myrie, Jerusalem correspondent for The New York Times. We've been talking about Hamas's political victory in the Palestinian election. The new members of parliament will be sworn in on Saturday. Hamas's charter calls for the destruction of Israel, and the organization remains unwilling to negotiate with Israel. Israel has already started certain unilateral actions, like pulling out of Gaza and like starting to build a separation barrier in the West Bank between Israeli and Palestinian territory. What further unilateral action do you think Israel might be considering now?
Right. I think, first of all, that is the most likely scenario, that Israel will look to act unilaterally. Now, Israel, of course, has its own national elections coming up on March 28th, and the Kadima, centrist Kadima party is very much the favorite. Ehud Olmert, who took over for Ariel Sharon, is leading that party, and he's certainly hinting at unilateral steps. I think the thing we'll see most immediately is Israel speeding up its work on this separation barrier in the West Bank. It's less than half complete. Israel keeps putting off a date for finishing it, but I think Olmert has really stressed that he wants to speed up work on that, and I think we will see that, and that is likely to, it may not be completed this year or even next year, but I think that's what Israel's talking about. So I think we will see more work on that. The larger question then becomes, what about those Israeli settlements that are beyond the separation barrier? It seems that of the quarter million or so settlers in the West Bank, you might have 60,000-70,000 who are beyond the barrier. Does that mean Israel is thinking about pulling them back? Well, certainly that's the speculation. We don't know. Olmert has not said. I think we'll get some more clarity after an election takes place. But I think that's the question. Will Israel look to start unilaterally pulling out some of these settlers who are beyond the separation barrier?
What is the political dialogue about this now, like in Israel? I mean, the elections are scheduled for the end of May. Ariel Sharon, the prime minister, is still in a coma. Ehud Olmert is the acting prime minister. Sharon had just started a new centrist party called Kadima. So what are, like, the major differences now between the centrists and the people on the right and the left?
Right. Ehud Olmert, in leading the Kadima party, has not defined exactly what he will do very clearly. And this party, this new party that was just created by Ariel Sharon in November, a month before he had his first stroke, and then before he had his more serious stroke, it's brought in people from both the right wing, some very hardline right wing members, and it's also brought in people like Shimon Peres. So it's a pretty diverse group, and they've tried not to define too precisely what they're going to do. There's a very broad general assumption that yes, they will look to take some unilateral actions. The one thing that Olmert says is he wants to define Israel's permanent borders, and that's largely assumed to mean something along the separation barrier or very close to it, as his idea of Israel's borders. But they don't go into too many specifics during this campaign. And this has shaken things up on both the right and the left. The right-wing Likud party, which Ariel Sharon led and which has been a leading force in Israeli politics for many years, has really suffered a complete crash in its poll numbers and looks to be maybe the third largest party. And they're trying to figure out where they're placing themselves now. The old position of Benjamin Netanyahu, the leader of Likud, says no territorial compromises without the Palestinians also making concessions, without an agreement where both sides get something. But Likud is having a very difficult time trying to place itself as a right-wing party. On the left in Israel, the Labor Party is talking a lot about social issues, about the gap between rich and poor Israelis, and trying to make that an election issue, but not getting a lot of traction. So right at the moment, this centrist Kadima party is very far ahead in the polls and seems to be doing very well without having to define itself too precisely, but with the assumption it will start taking some sort of unilateral steps after the election.
Now, Kadima wants to withdraw to approximately the boundaries before the war of 1967. What would that mean? What
Well, the 1967 borders would make a quite considerable contraction of what a lot of Israelis have thought that they would end up with. And at the moment, there are 250,000 settlers in the West Bank, and that doesn't include East Jerusalem, where there are another 200,000 or more Israelis, and Israel annexed East Jerusalem. So you're looking at 450,000 or so Israelis who are living beyond those 1967 borders in what was the West Bank. We saw last summer how difficult it was for Israel just to remove 9,000 settlers from the Gaza Strip, and now we're talking about a figure, much larger of that in the West Bank. I think, again, if there was a point of general consensus here at the moment, it's that Israel says it will hold the major settlement blocks. Much of these are just across the 67 borders in East Jerusalem or Maale Adumim, which is a big settlement just further east, the Gush Etzion block to the south of Jerusalem. So some of these main settlement blocks is what Israel is talking about keeping, and this would include the bulk of those West Bank settlers. And the separation barrier that is being built under its current route, and it keeps getting adjusted a little bit one way or another, would take up roughly 10% of the West Bank. And so that would leave 90% of the West Bank, which would seemingly be for a Palestinian state. Now, the Palestinians say that is not going to be good enough by any means, that 10% of land that remains is good land, it's important land, it's good farmland, water resources are there, and most importantly, it includes East Jerusalem. So that's not going to be a solution acceptable to the Palestinians, but it seems to point in the general direction which things may move.
My guest is Greg Myrie, Jerusalem correspondent for The New York Times. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Greg Myrie, Jerusalem correspondent for The New York Times. Israel has unilaterally pulled out of Gaza. How often have you been to Gaza since the pullout?
Quite frequently, both regularly since then.
How has it changed?
Well, it is, you're free to move around Gaza. You don't go halfway through there and run into an Israeli checkpoint, or you don't run into, the freedom of movement within Gaza is there now. Now, Israel still controls the borders, and the Palestinians say, therefore, not that much has changed. It's difficult for the Palestinians to really develop an economy, to maintain any real sort of normal lifestyle, because Gaza is a small, confined place. It's only about 6-7 miles wide, about 25 miles long, Gaza has to deal with the outside world. But within Gaza, the level of tension is down somewhat because there are no Israelis inside Gaza itself. The settlements that were evacuated, which made up about 20% of the land there, not a lot has happened. The 1,500 settlement homes that Israelis lived in have been torn down and mostly are still sitting there. The one thing we've seen is that the Palestinians have taken over these large greenhouses that the Israelis left behind. The Palestinians repaired them, fixed them up quite quickly, grew a winter crop, are harvesting that winter crop. But then we get back to the other problem of the borders. They have to get those crops out. It's flowers and strawberries and cherry tomatoes, which go to Israel and to Europe and the Arab world. And we had a problem at the Karni crossing, the place where these goods are exported. Israel said that a tunnel was being dug and that an attack was being planned on Karni. It was closed for 3 weeks. The Palestinians complained, saying millions of dollars worth of our produce were ruined, rotted while it was waiting to be exported. And so we're seeing some problems. There was also a shooting incident up at the northern crossing out of Gaza, where 5,000 Palestinians were still allowed to come out of Gaza and work in Israel each day. That caused a temporary closure. So the Palestinians are still not able to move outside of Gaza, but Israel says this is because they're continuing to carry out attacks.
How long have you been covering Israel and the Palestinians?
About 6 years now.
What are some of the biggest changes you've seen in those 6 years?
Well, I think that the main one would just be the atmosphere and the freedom of movement. When I arrived at the beginning of 2000, you could drive around and not know whether you were in Israel or the West Bank. You rarely saw soldiers. There were no real checkpoints. So you could move about quite freely between the West Bank and Israel at that time. 150,000 Palestinians would come into Israel every day to work. The economies were very much integrated at that point. It seemed like there was momentum towards some sort of peace agreement, even if not immediately within the next couple years. And now there's just this total division. It's very, very difficult for a Palestinian in the West Bank or Gaza to come into Israel. Israelis who used to go to the West Bank maybe on a Saturday to shop or have lunch have completely stopped that type of thing. There was the notion that the two sides could live together, separate states perhaps, but still live together and interact. That notion, for the time being at least, has certainly been cut off. I think Israelis, even Israelis who say they're very interested in a peace agreement, still want a full separation from the Palestinians. Now, they're over there, we're over here. That's the kind of thing you'll hear an Israeli say. And that's been the biggest change in the past few years.
How much access have you had to the leadership of Hamas?
The Hamas leadership has been pretty accessible in this sort of informal way that they operate. To see the top Hamas leaders down in Gaza City, which is where most of them have been, you would literally go and knock on their doors and wait for them or catch them at the mosque after they prayed. And even after they won the election, and perhaps surprising even themselves, this was still the way they operated to get their top leaders, even at times when Israel was carrying out airstrikes and killing some Hamas leaders. At times, they would certainly go into hiding and stop answering their cell phones. But I remember certainly any number of times where you would just knock on their door, wait, and one of their kids would answer and invite you into the house. And that's still how they operate. They don't have a main office in Gaza. They literally run, to a large extent, run their operation from the homes of their leaders. And you catch them there, and they hold their press conferences in their living rooms of their homes. And they have been pretty available. Again, at times when Israel is carrying out airstrikes, they become a little more scarce. But they're still around. They're there, and they're willing to talk. And we'll have to see how this relationships develop as they become a government, and whether they put layers of bureaucracy between themselves and the media.
In one of your recent articles, you wrote about a Hamas leader named Dr. Mahmoud Zahar. Am I saying his name correctly?
Mahmoud Zahar.
Uh-huh. He's a surgeon and a senior leader of Hamas, and he was asked about his medical specialty. Was it you who asked that question?
Yes, it was.
Tell us what happened.
Well, this was a couple years ago at a time when there was very intense violence and a lot going on. I was sitting in the living room of his home and just asking a little bit about his background. I knew he was a surgeon, and I asked him what his specialty was, and he said, thyroids. I'm very good at cutting throats. And big smile came across his face, and I think he knew he's dealing with the Western media and likes to play a little bit off his reputation. So this is the... I don't know how you interpret that. This is not a guy who likes to joke a lot, but he seemed pretty happy to joke about that. A few months later, I might add, the house where I was sitting in at that time was bombed by the Israelis, and Zahar is one of his one of his sons. I can't remember his exact age, was killed. His wife was injured. Zahar himself was hurt. So the Hamas leadership is made up of people who are very well educated, like Zahar, who is a doctor. There's others who are their leader in exile. profile is a physicist. They have others who are highly educated, but who are also very much supportive of the program they've carried out and are completely behind their bombing campaign that they've carried out. So there can be some dissidence there between sitting and talking with people who are very highly educated and very thoughtful, yet who are absolutely supportive and promising to continue to support positions of violence and suicide bombings.
How much do you talk to leaders of Hamas when you interview them about their ideology?
You know that ideology pretty well, and after you've had that conversation a couple times, you don't expect to hear a whole lot new and a whole lot that will change. What you try to find is there any shift in their positions? Again, when they talk about the possibility of a long-term truce with Israel or something like that. But there's been no real shift in their ideology since they were formed in the late 1980s, 1987 to be precise. It's based on their covenant, which they've is there for all to see, and based on their interpretation of Islam, and they haven't really because of that. It's not something that they consider changeable or can move a lot. Now they are practical. I would add, having said that they are practical, and they've had a reputation for being sensitive to public opinion. At certain times, you've seen them increase attacks when they felt that was the mood of the Palestinian public or they thought it might be effective. In the past year, we've seen them be disciplined and observe their truce because they felt that they wanted to push forward with their political program. We've seen the results of that. They've surprised everybody with their results. So ideologically, I think they are pretty fixed. It's hard to see that ideology changing. But in some way, politically, they have shown some pragmatism, at least certainly in dealing with what they feel are the Palestinian people and their ideas.
What are some of the risks that Israel and the United States face if they cut off aid and if they don't deal directly with the Hamas government, whether the intention is to actually oust Hamas or not? What are the risks they run by not recognizing Hamas?
Well, the risk would be that you would lose any link or any way to communicate or have a dialogue and perhaps moderate the Hamas government. The lines, even in the past 5 years of very intense fighting that we've seen here between Israel and the Palestinians, there have been contacts and a dialogue. Again, not full-fledged political negotiations by any means, and often that dialogue has been very limited. But generally, it has still been possible for the Israeli government to talk to Palestinian leaders or Palestinian security officials, and the same thing for the U.S. Government. U.S. diplomats in the region have maintained that dialogue, and that has, even though that has not solved problems in major problems or renewed peace talks, I think it has calmed down tensions at certain times. If there is no dialogue, and if for example the U.S. government is not having any contact with the Hamas government, and the violence does pick up again, that dialogue is just not there, and so that could be very problematic. Also, a Hamas government, if it does in fact turn to other Arab or Muslim countries and does start to receive money from Iran or Saudi Arabia or other sources, may feel even further right in its decision not to deal with Israel. And so the contacts, even during periods of violence, are still there and have some moderating or damping down effect, and those could disappear.
Well, Greg Myrie, thank you very much for talking with us.
My pleasure.
Greg Myrie is Jerusalem correspondent for the New York Times. He spoke to us from Jerusalem. Our interview was recorded this morning. Thank you. Coming up, Ken Tucker tells us about a website that collects video of vintage rock, soul, and funk performances. This is Fresh Air. A website introduced in December called YouTube.com features a vast array of video material, including a lot of vintage rock, soul, and funk performances that are making rock critic Ken Tucker bleary-eyed from addictive viewing.
That's Mark Bolan and T-Rex glamming their way through a primo performance of Get It On, Bang A Gong, with, on keyboards as special guest, a young Elton John. How young? He's got his own hair. It's one of the hundreds, probably thousands, of musical moments to be watched on YouTube.com. If you enter the site, bring along a caffeinated beverage and prepare to get hooked. A typical afternoon for me was downloading a stupendous 1969 performance by George Clinton and Parliament doing their early hit, I Wanna Testify. Watching Clinton's P-Funk made me think of James Brown's Primal Funk, so I did a search and located a clip of the hardest working man in show business singing an undated in every sense duet with the recently deceased Wilson Pickett, both men applying their utterly different growly voices to a ferocious version of Cold Sweat. Okay, before I get emails accusing me of illegal downloading, here's how YouTube works. You go to the site, search for the performer you want, select the piece, and it streams the video onto your computer. You don't download it, you can't keep it in that sense. The small company behind YouTube recently told the New York Times that uploaders must consent that the video they're providing isn't breaking any copyright law. But if a copyright holder comes to them and asserts ownership of that property, the site takes it down immediately. I know this happens because the first day I signed on, I watched Jerry Lee Lewis do a beautiful version of Hank Williams' You Win Again, surrounded by screaming 50s teenagers, and the next day the link had vanished, never to be seen again. The whole YouTube music experience is like a dream. You come across things you weren't even looking for, making connections as you search the site, saying, if they have the LA punk band Fear, maybe they'll have the Germs. And presto, the music just floats up in front of you. That's what happened to me when I decided to leave howling punk bands and search for Howlin' Wolf.
Got a lazy woman, then you have to come in and tell us that. Baby, why don't you sweep up the house? And she'll jump up and tell you, sweep it up yourself. I'm gonna get up in the morning, I believe I dust my broom. I'm gonna get up in the morning, I believe I dust my broom. I'm quitting the gal I'm loving while my friends can have my room. I believe.
The disadvantage to YouTube is that there's very little information about the dates of the stuff you're watching. So unless you're up on the history of a performance, it can be frustrating. But the rip in the space-time continuum created by the ability to leap from Ella Fitzgerald to the Sex Pistols to Ricky Nelson on Ozzy and Harriet is a trip whose dizzying disorientation becomes part of the pleasure. For as long as it lasts, YouTube's musical mystery tour makes every note ever played sound like it was just hanging in the air, waiting for you to hear it.
Ken Tucker is editor-at-large for Entertainment Weekly. That website he's been talking about is youtube.com. That's YOUTUBE. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced and edited by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, Ian Chillog, Patty Leswing, and Sam Brigger. I'm Terry Gross.
I've been waiting in school all day long, waiting on the bell to ring so I can go home. Throw my books on the table, pick up the telephone. Hello, baby, let's get some going. Heading down to the drugstore to get a soda pop, throw a nickel in the jukebox, then we touch the rock. Look out, baby, gonna tell you some news. You sure look good, and then, baby, doll shoe. Well, it's a one, two, pull up your shoes. Three, four, get out on the floor. Five, six, come get your kicks down the corner of Lincoln and a 46. Yeah!
Go.
I've been waiting in school all day long, waiting on the bell to ring so I can.
Support for NPR comes from the Pew Charitable Trusts, serving the public interest through information, policy solutions, and support for civic life. Online at pewtrusts.org. And from Diane Wolfe of New York and Washington, D.C., in great appreciation of NPR's mission to create a more informed public. CDs and transcripts of Fresh Air are available from Burrell's Loose at 1-877-21-FRESH. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Paul Pillar, the former CIA official who now says that the Bush administration misused intelligence to justify decisions that were already made, like going to war in Iraq. From 2000 to 2005, Pillar was the CIA's national intelligence officer for the Near East and South Asia. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.